Why don't we invent our own ghost stories?
A competition?
Yes! The five of us.
What about a dark English nobleman who draws women to him, sucks their blood and discards them empty?
Oh, yes. Or an obscene Italian doctor raised by the Benedictines who turns to sin and buggery.
What about a murder?
Or is murdered? Yes. Our own ghost stories. I've always wanted to write the idea of a classical vampire in a modern setting.
What about you, Mr. Shelley?
I'm too restrained by narrative prose.
Not so, Miss Godwin.
Oh, I defer to the more experienced writers.
Alas, my only talent is a good singing voice.
Hardly your only talent, my dear.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop, and with me today, as always, is Sam Stipendinko. Happy birthday.
Thank you. It's very belated.
It is very belated, but it was December 23rd, and we weren't recording, so this is your birthday pick this week.
Yes, and I'm guessing you're mad at me again.
We'll get there. And back in Planet Vulcan is Trish Coughlin.
Yes. Hello. Happy very belated, Sam.
Thank you.
Yes. So, thus continues the reason why I only give you one pick a year.
Well, I do it on purpose now.
This is how we sneak in our weird ones that we want.
Yes. I guess it's not like Liquid Sky, but...
That wasn't a birthday pick. That one was you and I talked about it. Went, that sounded really cool.
That's true.
And it wasn't.
Sam made a compelling argument.
Yeah, it was, look at the IMDb. This sounds like fun. That was my argument.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm willing to take responsibility for at least part of that.
Still had more of a plot than this one. We're going to be talking about Gothic from 1986, the psychedelic Ken Russell movie about the Shelleys, well, Percy Shelley and Mary Godwin. They weren't married yet. And their visit to Lord Byron, where they eventually come up with their horror stories, one of them being Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yes.
But this is kind of the lead up to it, Ken Russell style.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you know there's going to be drugs involved.
Yes.
Yeah. Ken Russell likes to do kind of historical drug-induced phenomena.
Yeah. So lots of opium and lots of laudanum.
Lots.
Lots. Oh,
it was an insane amount.
Yeah. That's probably about the only fictional part of the movie, though. I had to do a lot of looking into this. I'm like, how do we remake this? Because it's a historical movie. And about the only thing he made up was the drug delusions. And kind of, because it was dealing with stuff that was actually happening in their lives at the time. Maybe not the vampires and the eyes and the boobies.
Yes.
Because that's very Ken Russell.
That's very Ken Russell.
It is.
It's going to be difficult, or at least different for us, because we're going to have to approach this from a way where we're not fucking around with history unless we go Quentin Tarantino and say, fuck it. Or, do it anyway.
Alternatively, I kind of had an idea where I didn't even know where to go with it. So I went with kind of, my casting reflects this, a Baz Luhrmann reimagining where it's
the musical
now. No, it's set now,
I toyed around with setting it in the present, but I don't think that works. I mean, the whole thing's about the Gothic setting. So.
Yes.
True.
And this kind of is the birth of that. I mean, this is the romantics of the 1800s, 19th century, and
And it birthed two classic pieces of horror fiction.
Yes. I mean, we're not just talking Frankenstein, but the modern romantic vampire was also born at this point, too.
Exactly, yeah.
Not where you think, either.
No.
I still don't know what Percy Shelley came up with. With the brief amount of time I had to do some research, I don't know what his story was.
His story was more about dealing with his insomnia and then his narcolepsy. I'm not sure what his issue was there, but...
No, I know what the movie's plot with him was, but the story he came up with later. Like, the movie actually doesn't get to the point where they tell each other their horror stories. Or at least...
Yeah.
It does in part, but historically it took Mary Shelley about 3 days at that home before she came up with something.
That's right, yeah.
And we do see in the movie the little nuggets of here and there, and maybe in part with her delusions and the loss of her daughter.
Yeah.
And boy, looking into her, she lost quite a few more children after
that. She did, yeah. So
what a tragic life she had.
Yeah. And that was very common in that era for children to die early in life, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, not just that. It was children were dying, women were dying in childbirth. It wasn't going well.
No, and then there was this whole free love thing, so everybody was sleeping with everybody. That's in the movie.
Yeah.
I'm like, and they mean everybody.
Oh, yeah. And then researching it afterwards, I'm like, oh, yeah, I can't take that out.
Nope. As a matter of fact, he toned it down a little bit from the sounds of it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, looking into it, he definitely toned it down. Although Mary was a little, even though she was about the free love, she was a little off-put by when Percy had made relations with her stepsister, yes. Claire.
Yeah.
That was a little cringy.
Yeah. I think that was another Ken Russell thing just to add some drama to the relationships.
Mm-hmm. But that's actually historical.
Yeah.
I mean, and sure, the fact that how much of history was actually in his movie was actually quite astounding.
It was.
Because coming out of this movie, I was not happy. Did not really enjoy this movie. I don't really like drug movies as a whole. And then I started looking into this and I'm like, well, kind of appreciate what he did, because there's a lot of actual real factual history here outside of the drug use.
Yeah. I mean, Claire's desire for Shelley was unrequited though, right?
Yeah. Well, and Byron too.
Yeah.
Like, she went out there because she'd already had an affair with Byron once before. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She's the one who introduced the Shelleys to Byron.
Yeah. And during that weekend, she does get pregnant, but all that's actual fact.
Yeah. Which is what I think makes this movie work for me, is because it is fact-based, because it's a tricky watch, because it requires your full attention.
Yeah,
it's so easy to miss stuff,
and I might have appreciated it more if I'd known some of that stuff going in. Yeah. But it was kind of nice just going with the clean slate and then doing the research afterwards. You know, like, all right, I do appreciate his approach, and I do know Hollywood had shopped around, other people had shopped around this story. It was just too serious. There was lacking in humor. This has humor. It was lacking in scares. It's Mary Shelley and Byron and Percy Shelley and Claire and
Dr. Polidori.
Dr. Polidori all telling horror stories to each other.
Yeah.
But it's people weren't pitching scary stories. Okay, yeah. I get that. And this one comes around with screenplay writer Stephen Volk. Got a little more polishing by Ken Russell as well. And out comes the studio, like, hey, that's kind of what we were looking for.
Yeah, and it's won awards.
Yeah. I mean, theatrically, it was a bust.
as you would expect, I think.
But it was a hit on home video.
Yeah.
And it really kind of kickstarted the second phase of Ken Russell's career. He kind of thought it might have been over at that point, and then video came along, and it kicked this movie out there and did really, really well on home video.
Well, yes. And the thing about Ken Russell is he is very much for a particular audience, right? Like so many of these art film directors, they don't make films for mass consumption.
Mm-hmm.
It's for a much smaller audience and therefore need to be smaller budget in order to make money.
Yeah. It's an expressionist film, and it's one of those ones that you kind of have to sit with a little bit. I kind of wish I'd watched it earlier in the week and let it digested more before this podcast.
When I said, let's do this, I did even say, I said, I have a feeling my nostalgia goggles are going to get broken again, but I don't think so this time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that as piece of art, it still stands up.
Yeah. As much as I was initially angry coming out of this one going, oh, what another pretentious piece of crap. And then the more I thought about it, I'm like, no, not really. I didn't enjoy it, but it doesn't mean it's not good.
Yes.
And it kind of is. It is good. It's just not something I enjoy.
No. I was kind of half expecting that, especially after watching it again. I'm like, this is not a J film.
No. And I'm pretty open-minded, but it's not a J film.
No, it's most definitely not. But it is a Sam film. It's the way it looks. Because for me, sometimes all it takes is a certain look in a film. Mm-hmm. And I love it, even if the story itself is meh.
I do like the look. Wasn't crazy about the sound mix. I had to turn it way up just to get the dialogue. And they're all speaking English. Why am I having trouble understanding them?
Right.
But, I mean, there's also part of the dialogue is period.
Yeah.
As well. So it does make it a little tougher to follow.
That's when subtitles are very handy.
Yeah.
I did do that. That's what I did. I should have.
They're always on in my house because I have a wife who likes to come down and talk while I'm watching these movies, so I can at least read it while she's talking at me.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's something about being able to absorb a movie more with the subtitles, but you can also make the argument, especially with an English one, I find it's distracting as well.
It can be. It can be, yeah. I use them as a supplement, right? And it works for me, but then I've been doing it for so long that I don't find them a distraction.
Like, I don't find them a distraction when I'm doing a foreign film. But I definitely do if I have them on when it's English.
Yeah, because you're listening, and then when the dialogue doesn't match up, you're like, that's not what they said.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, that's the thing I have trouble with. I'm like, that's not it.
Exactly. All right, well, I'm going to run the trailer here for Gothic 1986. We'll get into the cast, and then we'll get right into the movie.
Before Mary Shelley could write her masterwork of terror, Frankenstein, she had to experience it.
I have it in mind to raise the dead.
Hurry.
Yes, the skull of the Black Monk. His appearance was said to herald disaster. Gaze into the eyes. Conjure up your deepest, darkest fear. Call that fear to form. To life.
That was the trailer for Gothic 1986 by director Ken Russell, who also had a hand in the screenplay, which was by Stephen Volk, who had written The Guardian. Now, director Ken Russell, we actually have talked about before in episode 138.
Altered States.
The original story, this is actually based on the original story by Lord Byron and Percy by Shelley. Some of their stuff that's been adapted have been like The Corsair and Don Juan, which was Byron. Classic romantic literature that I'm sure most people have only seen movie adaptions of.
Yes, or been forced to read in school.
That's right, unless you got a literature degree. oddly enough, before coming into this, like about 2 weeks ago, I had a whole discussion with one of my clients at work about Percy Shelley and Mary Shelley and some of this stuff. So some of it was in the back of my brain.
See, and there were all kinds of signs saying this is what we need to do this week.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I did a coin flip between this and another Ken Russell film.
and yeah, it came up three times this one.
So. Yeah.
This stars Gabriel Byrne as Byron, who seems a lot older than the rest of the cast, but I think he's always had that old face.
Yeah, and he was older than the rest of the Shelleys and Claire as well.
Okay.
By quite a few years, actually, by about 5 or 6 years.
Right. Yeah, it's not going to be reflected in my casting. We've talked about him several times, actually. I was quite surprised at how many times he's popped up at this point. Episode 30.
Point of No Return.
Episode 120.
Assault on Precinct 13.
And 193.
The Keep.
That's right. And this makes number 4. And the late Julian Sands is Percy Shelley. We talked about him in episode 145.
Arachnophobia.
And episode 238.
I missed that one.
The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Oh, I forgot we did that one.
Yeah. It's weird kind of covering him now because, you know, he's passed on. He went missing hiking and they eventually found his remains almost a year later.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, according to his IMDb, this January when we're recording this is a 1 year anniversary of his passing.
Wow. Yeah. He was one of the greats. I think he was one of the like more underrated actors out there, but I always liked how his performance and the cadence, his voice.
Yes. Yeah.
Natasha Richardson is Mary, and she was in Made in Manhattan and The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes, she had a short but bright career.
Oh, yeah. She's wonderful.
Miriam Sir is Claire, and she really likes the Frankenstein story. She was in Frankenstein and Me and Frankenstein Unbound, and this makes 3.
This makes 3.
There you go.
Timothy Spall. One of Sam's favorites.
Yes, I've used him in casting quite a bit.
Yeah, he plays Dr. Polidori, and of course, most people remember him as Wormtail in the Harry Potter films, but we talked about him in episode 398, which Sam was not a part of, but that was Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah. Alec Magno is Murray, or Murray. Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. It was his last movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this was his last one. But, you know, when you stretch back that far.
Yeah, because I think his career goes back to the 1930s.
Yeah, yeah. And Voyage of Sinbad was 50s, mid-50s. Andreas Wisniewski is Fletcher. And, wow, some good action stuff in his resume here. The Living Daylights, Die Hard, and Mission Impossible.
That's a pretty good pedigree for action films.
God damn right it is. Dexter Fletcher is Rushton, and he directed Rocket Man.
And Ghost directed the Queen film as well.
Yeah, and you might remember him as an actor in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
Yeah, it's funny. Every time he pops up, I'm like, I really like him as an actor. I remember the first time I saw him was in a film called The Rachel Papers, which is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of those underrated actors that he's that guy you saw in that thing that one time.
I think he's an underrated actor, too.
Yeah, he is, too, yeah.
Yeah. Pascal King is Justine and just various TV stuff. This is the last movie, in fact, the only feature film that Pascal did. Tom Hickey is the tour guide. He was in My Left Foot and Possession. And Kieran Shaw is Fuseli, the monster from the painting. Just a tiny part, but for a tiny man, he's in some good stuff. We never mentioned him, but he was in all 3 Star Wars episodes. He did the new trilogy.
Okay.
So we would have talked about those in episode 23, 123, and 223. And he was also in the Hobbit trilogy as well. So he's gotten into some pretty good stuff.
Yes, he has.
Yeah, pretty good and long career. But primarily, it's about 5 people.
Yes. Yeah. I was actually surprised by how big the cast actually was, because I don't remember seeing that many people in the film.
Well, it's the butlers and the maids that they're there, but don't have that much of a presence.
Exactly.
No. Right.
And then there's the automaton woman, which I really dug.
Yeah, which makes no sense.
That's the part about this whole movie is it's supposed to be a fever dream, a drug-induced dream, so a lot of it doesn't make sense. And that's what makes it so lovely to me.
Yeah, it is and it isn't, because I feel like sometimes it's like, well, we don't know enough about this person, so let's make... You can tell what fever dreams were inspired by the traumas of their personal history, yeah, and other ones that just Ken Russell made them up.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I mean, and that's the reality of drug use, is you do have these experiences that make no sense to you, mm-hmm, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right. I mean, I've never done laudanum or opium, no, nor will I ever.
Because you don't live in the 1900s.
And
or 1800s, no, even.
Exactly. Well, and I don't do drugs. So that's probably a factor as well. But yeah, I kind of have the feeling that was what he was trying to go for, is trying to give you sort of that fractured experience that you can get on drugs that can alter your perception.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think also with the belief that it made sense to him that something groundbreaking had to be done with drugs.
I think that's part of it, right? And I think the animatronic woman was supposed to be something that was in Byron's house, because he,
yeah,
was sort of a quirky collector of oddities as well. So I think it was just sort of an experience that he had, more so than a drug experience.
Mm-hmm.
That was the way I saw it in the film, because they weren't too deep into their drug experience when that particular scene happened.
Yeah, it seemed a little more lucid at that, yeah, point. And then there's that other weird scene where one of the maids comes in, strips down, and puts on a mask. That was, which may or may not have actually happened.
Well,
yeah,
that one just felt like it cut off early.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't quite finished. I think it may have been something that got left on the cutting room floor. There was more to it that may have made more sense, because mm-hmm, it just did feel like it cut really oddly.
Mm-hmm.
It was. It was weird. They were somewhat trying to humanize Byron by his incestuous obsession with his sister.
Not his sister. It was that was Mary Shelley's stepsister.
No. When she had the maid wearing the mask.
Oh.
She used to be impersonating his, yeah, sister.
Yeah, they really portray Byron as a Marquis de Sade-esque type of person in this movie. Abusive and very sexual and controlling.
Well, he was
people
manic
around him and his staff.
Right. If you read about his biography, he did have manic episodes. Mm-hmm. So I think they're trying to relay that through film. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I felt he was
just mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of got that vibe off him too. Is I'm not sure that Byrne knew what to do with that particular aspect of the personality,
and yeah,
quite land the way I think he wanted it to.
I think they portrayed him as being sadistic when I think he was truly jealous of Mary and her relationship with Shelley.
Maybe to a certain extent. And I think maybe he didn't know how to deal with her as well, because she was not putting up with his shit either. Right. Mm-hmm. Like she called him out. She called him about the pregnancy. She called him out about his behavior. So that just by its very nature, when you have two strong personalities like that, you get antagonism.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yes.
All right. And I think that was part of their relationship.
Yes.
And I got the feeling the drugs were how he tried to control his episodes.
Possibly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Self-medicating.
In the era, there's a reason why he was living with his physician.
Yes. Very Michael Jackson-esque.
Uh-huh. Right. The original One Glove Maniac.
Yeah.
There you go.
But it was a cloven-footed maniac.
He had that clubbed foot, and then they kept that in the movie with the cane. Like, they tried to be as accurate as possible. And that makes things tough for us
because
of how we're going to interpret this. I did toy with the idea of modern day, but I don't think that's the way to go. I think it's a case of how we use their traumas to inspire their stories.
That's right. And that's where you get to play with it a little bit, is the drug experiences versus the real life portion of it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure if the drug experiences are wholly necessary. I mean, it is an aspect of that. That's Ken Russell's movie.
Yes.
And that's the way he likes to do things. Now, is that something that's completely necessary or not? I'm not sure. We could flash into, I don't know. You know, I'm having a tough time with this one, because it's strange. In a way, this movie is an anthology told in bits and pieces without breaking away from the characters.
Yeah, I was about to say, it seemed to be, there's just moments in it in many ways where you're in a scene and in a moment, and then you're moved on to another scene in another moment.
Yeah.
And that's not quite what I want to do with this.
No, I mean, you could focus it more on the storytelling that they were doing early in the film, where they are trying to scare each other and telling these...
Well, that's the story I wanted. That's the story I wanted to hear each of their stories a little more succinctly and then kind of break into those stories. I mean, it's a fucking shame that we don't get an image of Frankenstein at some point in this movie.
Exactly.
Like, it feels like masturbating and never finishing.
Yeah. That's called edging.
Very true. But I had an idea, and I honestly was going to do this in the current time thing, is like you start with the story, but you can also like again break out into the story, but it will star Claire and Mary and Lord Byron and Shelley just as the characters in the story.
Well, I don't want to mess with history, but I mean they do have some present day stuff with tourists and things like that and trying to start story that way in this movie.
I mean, I don't want to mess with the story in that way. What I'm saying is like when they are doing their storytelling, the characters become the characters in the story.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Kind of like waxwork.
Yes, I was just thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
But better.
Yes.
Well, and that would be a not bad way to go, because you could pull the traumas in and how these characters are affecting each other through their stories and the interpretation from the storyteller. By inserting the character, these people around them as characters in their stories.
Exactly. And I mean, this could be at the end of that 3-day period where Mary was coming up with her idea for Frankenstein, rather than cramming that 3 days into a single night,
like
Ken Russell did, because it did happen over a period of time.
Yeah.
And I can assure you that there was probably some drug use during those 3 days. They were all very experimental people, but was it as extreme as it was in Russell's film?
As a big bottle of laudanum? No. Yeah,
probably not. No, it's probably used just to enhance the storytelling experience or to manage pain or mood swings like you suggested.
Yeah.
All right. And we could even bring that into the film.
Yeah. I mean, really, you come for Frankenstein, but you stay for the subversive anarchist hedonists. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
We only got one orgy scene? What?
Yeah, there's only one orgy scene. And I was like going, I know the story. And I, for some reason, I thought there was more in this movie and there just wasn't. Because it is Ken Russell.
Yeah, well, when it came out, that was still pretty progressive. But now it's very tame to us.
The orgy scene in The Boys was far more graphic than this one. It was very tastefully done. In fact, the layout of that scene felt like a painting to me, a Victorian painting.
And I think that Russell was going for that for a lot of his shots.
Yeah. I mean, well, specifically that little demon boy.
Yeah.
That was
The Nightmare.
Yeah.
Is the nightmare. Name of the painting.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was an actual painting that they used as
reference.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, for North American advertising, they took the nightmare out and just had Natasha Richardson lying there in that same position. And people were like, this makes no sense. What does this mean?
Yeah.
Because it was too scary.
It was just bizarre to even think about.
Yeah. And another reason that maybe it didn't do very well.
Yeah, well, for a theatrical audience looking for escape, this isn't quite that.
No.
But it's also not the Oscar audience either. It's an underground audience. Like, even a few years ago, you probably couldn't have got this movie made.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this kind of exists in its bubble of time. But I think you could now.
I think so, too, because, I mean, especially if you lean more into the giallo aspects of it, because there was some of that feel to it as well. So, so I think if you lean more to that, and giallo's making a comeback with, like, Last Night in Soho, and so many other films are kind of leaning into that look.
Yeah, it had that surreal look to it, the color palettes. There was definitely choices made in the sets and camera angles and music, that felt very Italian.
Yes. Oddly enough, the soundtrack was by Thomas Dolby.
Weird. I looked at that too. I was like, what the hell?
Yeah. That just makes it even odder because it didn't fit. The soundtrack is so odd.
It is so odd because it's very modern in a period film.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, totally.
I've seen that done in a few films where they'll bring in a modern soundtrack to a medieval setting.
And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, it worked really well in A Knight's Tale because it was part of the story.
Yeah.
Right? But in this one, it was one of the few things that did feel out of place in the film was that soundtrack.
Yeah. Maybe that was there to be off-putting. Yeah. Like, maybe it was supposed to make you feel a certain way that things weren't meshing up, and so you could feel part of their drug-fueled reality.
Yeah, yeah, to try and throw you a little off balance throughout the film. And if that was the case, it did work.
Yeah.
And this is out of time. You have a moment where Mary is going to the doors, and it seems like she's seeing the future and the past. It's wild.
Yeah.
Well, that's the foresight of a filmmaker who knows all the past.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can play with reality in such ways because you as the filmmaker have total control of that. And you can manipulate the characters in a certain way. I mean, that's just one of those fun little film tricks that you can start playing with, especially when you got a drug-fueled story where fucking the rules don't even matter anymore.
Really, they don't. And I mean, and when you're dealing with people, they're not just characters, they're actual people. Mm-hmm. Like Mary Shelley, who is frequently considered the mother of science fiction.
Yeah. Yes.
So to have modern aspects works really well.
Mm-hmm.
Just the fact that this weekend existed in real life blows my mind that you have two of the most iconic creatures in horror kind of birthed in this one weekend.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Because like the vampire predates Bram Stoker's.
Yes.
So yes. That's...
But yeah. Frankenstein's, we're going on hundreds of years now. Yeah. Over 200 years. That's amazing.
1816, I want to say it was published
somewhere around there. It's pretty mind blowing that this all happened, and it really happened with these people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with a female author in mind in that time. I mean, the first printings of Frankenstein went anonymous because female writer, and then you have Percy doing the foreword, so they think Percy wrote it.
Yes.
And really, historically, and people have researched it, he did nothing more than an editor would do today. Yeah.
He did less than what the quote was, he did less than what a modern line editor would do now.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they can tell because the handwritings, right? I mean, everything was handwritten back then.
Yeah. There are no typewriters. Yeah. And
you don't have to look at who is the editor. Like, you don't do a word who signed in and did the last.
Last edit on the page.
Can't do it.
Yeah. Considering how successful that story is, the Shelleys always struggled with money and continuously moved around. But there was a certain lifestyle that they liked to live, so it's no wonder they were broke all the time.
Yes.
Oh, hell yeah.
And I mean, they were together for a relatively short period of time because both Shelley and Byron died quite young. And Polidori did too.
Well, yeah. Mary died in her 50s.
Yeah. But Percy Shelley didn't even make it to 30.
Yeah. And Mary and Claire were the only ones who kind of survived even a significant amount of time later.
Yeah, because Polidori took his own life before he turned 30 as well.
Yeah. Percy married again after Mary.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he still, I think, was only 29 when he passed.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, at that time of the ages, it's sort of like, yeah, you got to get those marriages in quick because you're not going to live as long as you think you will. Even with him dying early, that was only marginally early.
Yeah, that was something I was trying to think about in my casting because when Percy met Mary, Mary was like 16. I'm like, I'm going to age them up a little bit so it's not so gross.
Yes, but not too much. I tried to cast age appropriate.
Well, I kind of did like actors in their 30s. Just look young. Yeah. You can kind of go either way with them. But people aged differently then too, right?
They certainly did. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just don't... Like having watched this, I knew we'd have a challenge remaking this because it's not something you can just remake whole cloth because it's, like you said, it's based very much in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a lot of wiggle room in terms of what you're going to do to make it different. I'm kind of on board with Trisha's idea of sort of having them telling their tales and having them step into the roles.
Yeah, I kind of like that as well. And I feel like you can still have the sexual encounters. I mean, that was all part of their lifestyle. And to a certain extent, the drugs might fuel the stories, but I don't want them running around the building screaming like maniacs the whole time.
No. No, that was – I will be honest. I found that Percy Shelley was rather annoying to watch most of the time because he was just so manic the whole time.
Yeah.
right? And I wanted to see...
Yeah, he was pretty pathetic.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a very sad character.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what you were supposed to feel, is that he was unstable and uncomfortable with who he was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was the weird. The worst part I kept going, like, he was going through, and it seemed they were banging this on the head early on, where he's talking about lightning is creation, doing all this, like, just kind of planting the seed that he just gave Mary the idea.
An oak tree struck by lightning, that's all.
It seemed alive. Lightning has a power beyond our imaginations. Yes. But aren't our imaginations even more powerful? Lightning destroyed it, but our imaginations brought it to life. To create a ghost story is nothing. Quickening of the heart, a brief half-image of terror in the end, nothing. But to create a ghost... Isn't your theory that lightning can endow a lifeless being with life? Perhaps that same lightning in our minds can take lifeless thoughts.
You are bored with poetry.
No, obviously. Sir, I'm bored with life.
So am I. Let us see if we can't bridge the Stygian gloom, eh? I mean, if we can't, then...
We can!
It does.
And that kind of peeved me.
Yeah, like I feel like these little nuggets throughout the weekend. I mean, it was kind of nice, but they stood out like a sore thumb. And it was like, oh, that all of that feels so forced when Byron calls Mary a modern Prometheus.
Yeah.
That didn't really feel accurate or right.
No, it felt like a
forced line
to suggest the whole Frankenstein story, so that it suggests that Shelley and Byron are the ones who gave her the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see where she would want to raise the dead. She's had a child who's gone, and this is kind of fueled by her traumas of ideas of maybe raising the dead, and it's happening over a stormy weekend where lightning and stuff, like, those are the things that inspire the story.
For sure. And we can't forget to mention her mother, who died in childbirth.
Yes.
Right.
Which could explain also his trauma of how he's cowering when the birth is happening in that one scene.
Possibly. There's so much to interpret in it. Right. And I think that's the beauty of the film, is you get to interpret the events.
Yeah. And yourself. You're not going to get it all in one watch.
No.
Yeah.
And nor do I want to keep picking at it and say, this means this means that. I'm not writing a book report for you.
No.
No.
If you're into it, watch it yourself and see how you feel. I mean, this is a movie about how you feel at the end of it.
In a lot of ways, most movies are meant to be that. And this one is very much designed to be that.
Yeah. And you do, one way or the other, right? Either you hate it or you feel kind of amazed that this is based in fact.
Well, you might hate it and it still might stick with you. Yeah. Hi, that's me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I can, it's weird. I like you, Sam, I love the look of it, but I'm also kind of repulsed by it.
In some ways, yeah. And I think you're supposed to be. I genuinely think you're supposed to be, because that behavior is not normal. Most of it is abhorrent.
And especially by today's standards.
Especially by today's standards.
I mean, a civilized cultures even back then, like, they were living at a uppity standard, but Byron had fled England and had no intention of returning, and the Shelleys kind of had a similar thing going on.
Exactly. When you think about this group of people, they were ostracized by society in a lot of ways because of their lifestyle and their behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think you're supposed to like them. The only sympathetic character in the whole film is supposed to be Mary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she is. But yeah, you're not supposed to like anybody else, right? I mean, Paula Dore with the whole Christian imagery scene and stuff like that, which I felt kind of didn't really take us anywhere.
Yeah.
It didn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was supposed to be our link to his vampire story, but
it didn't take us anywhere.
No, it didn't. And they didn't really concentrate too much on it. He was just kind of cowering in his room most of the time.
Yes.
The stuff we did with Claire, though, was bonkers.
It was bonkers, but the way that he bounced that scene back and forth between Byron and Claire was really, really fantastic to watch. Mm-hmm. But neither scene, well, actually, the one scene did make sense, but the other scene didn't make sense enough to warrant the way that it was shot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I love the bouncing back and forth.
Yeah.
Right? You have this very sort of pseudo-erotic scene, and I do say pseudo-erotic, and then this really traumatic scene with Polidori, and it juxtaposed so nicely. Mm-hmm. But at the end of Polidori's scene, you're still not sure what's going on with him.
Yeah. And I wasn't sure if they were trying to make a scary movie or a comedy. And I'm not sure if they succeeded at either front.
No.
They didn't, because it wasn't scary and it wasn't funny.
I think it was just absurd.
I think it was supposed to be a character study in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it was characters with so little character.
Yeah, when you only have an experience with them on drugs,
yeah,
you don't get to really understand them that much outside of trying to interpret the visuals and then things that they've said in the dialogue that kind of set things up.
Yeah, and see, I think that's one of the things that was missing in this film is we showed Claire and the Shelleys arriving on their boat, and they're already kind of over-exuberant. So there's none of those moments of seriousness that you need before they get into their evening to establish who they are. I mean, these are very passionate, intelligent people. So yes. I think that you would need to have that dinner conversation should be about poetry and art and writing and show that these people are smart, introspective people. And then as the night deteriorates, so do they. And I think that was missing. It goes straight into they're all kind of nuts.
Yeah, and it really makes it hard to grab on anything.
Yeah. I mean, the only time that you get them in a sober moment is at the end of the film.
Yeah, where they go, eh, it was a hell of a night.
But yeah.
It's just that. Leave it there.
And sad thing is we've all kind of had those mornings.
Well, yeah.
Maybe not to that extreme, but we've all had those mornings where it's like, whoa, hell of a night. But the night was the night and the day was the day, as they said.
Yeah. Well, stories that came out of this weekend, obviously Mary Godwin, who would later become Mary Shelley, wrote Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus. Dr. John William Polidori wrote The Vampire, which is the progenitor to the romantic vampire genre.
Yeah.
So we wouldn't have Anne Rice without this.
Nope. Or Dracula.
Or Dracula. The vampire also inspired Lord Byron's story, A Fragment. I have no idea what Percy came up with based on this weekend. What little digging I did, I couldn't find the answer to that one.
And Claire also wrote?
Yeah, I don't know anything about what Claire came up with.
She kind of faded into obscurity as far as being a writer goes, but she did write quite a bit. But none of it really captured public attention.
Yeah, well, and I did like the fact that Mary wasn't, I mean, she was an intellectual, but they weren't portraying her as a writer. I think it was this weekend that they were trying to say inspired her to be a writer.
Yes.
And she was quite prolific.
She was quite prolific, yeah. And again, wrote something that's still in public consciousness today.
Yeah, I mean,
she had published poetry before this. She'd been published before.
Yeah, I mean, history's kind of made her the woman who created Frankenstein and the wife to Percy, but that's just her most memorable piece. But I mean, they've done movie adaptions of Matilda as well.
Yes, they have.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably her next biggest piece.
There's lots of depth to Mary Shelley that we didn't get to see in this movie.
Yeah.
All right. And I think that may be one of the first things we would need to do is take that sort of clusterfuck of an opening scene, tighten that up and have the quiet moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think we should be in such a hurry to get to the opium and laudanum.
No, I think that one thing that would make it work really well is the gradual deterioration. And as a filmmaker, you could show that not only through their behavior, but through the way the film looks.
And you could even distort the backgrounds. Yeah. And as we start fading into their stories or their delusions as the stories.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, that would be pretty cool. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, now I'm directing it, not just rewriting it.
But, you know, in a part, we kind of have to because, you know, the story is the story.
Yeah.
We know the story. We don't know how we're going to present it. And that's the change of this story.
Yeah. And we can change the fantastical moments, right? And that's where we get to play a little bit, right? So I think, like we said, Trish's idea of having them sort of telling their ideas and having them as little vignettes, I think is a good way to do that without making it as crazy as the original film was.
No, this was Fear and Loathing in Switzerland.
Yeah.
I love that. That should be the name of the movie.
All right. Well, with that, do we want to break into some casting? I mean, the changes are don't take a lot of describing because we kind of know what those stories are going to be.
Yes.
It's going to be those stories. I'd have to do a lot more research into Claire and Percy to find out what those stories that they came up with. But, you know, we want those to be somewhat accurate. And if we can't, then that's our opportunity to make some shit up.
Yes.
Well, Percy Shelley, he was more of a poet.
He was, yeah.
So, I mean, his story, I don't think would be so much of a story as like kind of an epic poem.
Mm-hmm.
About something. And that we can actually make, I think, not Ken Russell-ish, but like have that one be a little bit
more visual,
more disjointed and visual.
Yeah. Hey, Beowulf was a poem.
Yeah.
You can tell there epic stories through poetry.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So he could totally do that.
Yeah.
And do some more digging on Claire. And you know what? I think with Paula Dore, I did want to bring him in a better way than they did in this movie.
But he spent a lot of time by himself. In this
he
film.
Did.
He didn't feel like part of the group, and I don't think he really was.
But
yeah,
I do
he wasn't
want
part
him
of that
be...
friends group, and I feel like that Byron was more controlling of him, and when they weren't agreeing, he just, fucked off to his room.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I do want him to be lurking a little bit, just because he does want to be part of it. Mm-hmm. I think he was ostracized and felt unhappy about it.
I would really like to lean into his desire for Byron, because he's in love with Byron, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's apparent in the film, but yes, I think that he would be present even on the fringes more,
mm-hmm.
right? Because of that.
You could open the movie rather than with the Shelleys arriving. You can have the opening of the movie with them preparing for the arrival, and you can have a bit of a romantic moment between the two of them to establish their relationship a little bit better, and then cut back to Percy and Mary.
Yeah,
that would work. Yeah, because and then it sets it up a little bit earlier in the film so that his jealousy of the relationship that Byron has with Claire.
Mm.
And
yes.
Byron does not have relationships.
Yeah.
He has sexual partners.
No. Yeah.
And that's very clear in this film.
Yeah. And to a certain extent, I think Percy's trying to be Byron, trying to live up to the same standards. There's hero worship there.
A certain amount, yes. Yeah. And I don't think you get enough of that in this film either.
Yeah.
Is the influence that Byron had on Shelley in this period of their lives.
Yeah. And you could tell that Mary could see it.
Yeah. I mean, there's that insinuation that Byron and Shelley were also lovers, that these were people were definitely poly.
Mm-hmm.
They were into everybody.
Yeah, I think they were.
Oh, yeah. No, that's... Yeah.
No reason to shy away.
No, not at all. Especially not in this day and age.
Oh.
Right. Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's something that you could deal with a lot more transparently in making this film now.
Yeah. They lived in an era where they weren't scared of things like AIDS.
No.
So. No.
Oh, hell no. Syphilis, yes.
Yes.
AIDS, no.
Yeah. But and I mean, and I love the fact that there were jealousies in this movie because it's a fact. Even when you try to have like that type of open free love type of aspect to relationships, there's always going to be a little bit of jealousy there because you have feelings. Mm-hmm. Feelings you are there. You can't do anything about that. It's how you manage those feelings. And that's part of what could be in this film as well, is how this weekend strengthened Percy's and Mary's relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they're actually not, I don't know, but it would be something that we could insinuate. And then the relationship that Paula Dore or the feelings that Paula Dore has for Byron, maybe that's what ultimately leads up to his taking his own life, is never having that fruition for that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's lots of things you can do with that.
Now that's some good stuff to grab onto.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, hey, old man, you got a cast for me?
I have a cast for you. I only cast the five because they're the ones that matter.
I did as well.
Yeah. So I'll start with my Byron. My Byron is Jamie Campbell Bauer. He played Vecna in Stranger Things.
Okay.
And a bunch of other stuff. He's fantastic. My Percy Shelley is Charlie Heaton. He is the older brother in Stranger Things. I didn't do it on purpose, but they're both fantastic English actors. And I liked that kind of wasted look that Charlie Heaton has. Mm-hmm. I thought it'd be perfect for Shelley.
Nice.
So my Mary, I'm with Anya Taylor-Joy.
That's very good.
For my Claire, I went with Maisie Williams. And then my Dr. Paula Dore, because he was actually the youngest member of that group. And so I went with a younger actor. His name is Joe Locke. He's in a TV series called Heartstopper that's in its second season. And again, I went with him for his look and his age. He actually looks quite a lot like the paintings of Paula Dore.
Oh, that's good. Oh, yeah, sweet. That was something that informed my casting.
Yeah.
And it was a bit unfortunate that I couldn't just pluck actors out of time, because looking at the paintings of these people, I could instantly go, oh, that looks like this person, that looks like this person, but they're all over the place and none of them are age appropriate. The ones that I would normally have put in those positions that looked so close to those photos.
Yeah, and that's why I went then. My cast, I think, kind of captures the essence without being like a doppelganger.
That's what I was going for too. Like close visually, but also has that the presence that I want from those characters.
Exactly. And then for my director, I went with Romain Bassett, who directed Horsehead, which is a film I really liked from 31 Days of Horror a couple years back. And specifically because of the way they use aspects of giallo in their filmmaking and taking this very surreal story and still having it be coherent.
Right.
So that was my cast and director.
Very good. Very good. All right. Trish, what do you got?
Okay, so out the gate, like I say, I was doing this a little off-brand, a Baz Luhrmann-esque type of reimagining. So none of my cast actually matched the visuals of the group.
I love the idea of this being a musical weekend.
I like their essence. So actually for Mary, I went with Zendaya. Shelley, Rahul Kohli, who is in The Fall of the House of Usher. He was one of the children, one of the bastards, as it were.
Was he for the, Byron, the club kid?
I went with Henry Golding, very good British actor. Claire, Vanessa Hudgens. And I don't know why, but like her portrayal in Polar seemed to be fit with the unhinged Claire that they were looking at. And my Dr. Polidori was Ian Alexander from the OA. They're a transgender sort of androgynous type of actor that I thought would be interesting to put in that realm. And for my director, I went with Karen Kusama, who did The Invitation, which I find is a very modern gothic movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, for me, like I said, I didn't want to make the characters too young because it felt too gross. So that's where I'm kind
of hard.
taking some liberties. So I kind of went with people in their 30s just because I know that people in their 20s in the 1800s look like they were 40. So
fair enough. Yeah.
So I was kind of going with that in mind, or hoping I could get away with it. Also, I was casting British actors that looked the part, looked close to the characters while still capturing their essence. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of what was inspiring me here. So Sam's going to really like my Byron, even though he's probably the youngest in the cast and should be the oldest. But ignore that part. For Byron, Robert Sheehan.
Nice.
Yep.
Looks the part, has the energy, comes to the right part of the world.
And he can be, God, what's the word? He can be a bastard, but God damn it, you still love him.
Yeah, yeah.
Charisma. That man has charisma coming out the wazoo.
Yeah.
Right?
If you're not sure who he is, he was in the Umbrella Academy on Netflix and Mortal Engines, the film that is way better than everybody says it is.
Yes. And I was first introduced to him in this British TV series called The Misfits, which is amazing.
That's how, where I first discovered him too, was The Misfits.
Yeah.
For Percy Shelley, Daniel Radcliffe.
I looked at him. I actually did look at him.
I love it.
Yeah. I thought, you know, the more I thought about it, and I mean, with The Woman in Black, he's played in that era, and he just likes doing off-kilter stuff like Guns Akimbo and Horns and
Yeah,
what was that one?
Swiss Army Man?
That was the one, Swiss Army Man. Yeah.
And you know what? I think he could just portray such a romantic. I think it would be so lovely.
Yeah, exactly. This is all about the romantics, right? For Mary, this is the one I'm like, oh, did I go Hollywood on this one too much? Keira Knightley. She looks the part.
Yeah, she still looks really damn young.
Yeah. And she's done like Pride and Prejudice, The Imitation Game. She's no stranger to period pieces, obviously Pirates.
Yeah. So. Yeah, no, I can get behind that.
Okay. For Claire, this is a tricky one, but I was thinking Jenna Coleman from Sandman, Victoria, and Jackdaw, which should be coming out this month, actually.
I can get behind that, too.
Yeah. And for Dr. Polidori, Dominic Cooper. He played Ian Fleming in the miniseries.
Preacher.
It's mainly his presence in Fleming.
That's the only ways that I'm letting you get away with that, because he looks the oldest of the bunch.
He does.
Yeah.
I mean, at the time, I thought a doctor or a physician would be, but I didn't even look at their actual ages.
Yeah. When you think that Polidori was like
29. He's not that much older than the rest of me.
No, but he looks older.
He does look older.
Yeah.
Again, I figured I could fudge it a bit, but...
We're taking a bit of artistic license. Yeah. We just are.
Now, I had two directors in mind, and it would be two very different feeling films as a result. I initially thought of Richard Stanley as a director.
Okay.
Hardware, Color Out of Space, and he would definitely be able to get into the colors and the psychedelics and probably really want to play with that.
Yes.
Then I thought, wait a minute. Who likes period stuff to an insane amount of detail? How about Robert Eggers? The Witch, Lighthouse. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, that could work really well. You know who actually crossed my mind for just a moment, just because he's so good at pretty, was Zack Snyder. But I think he'd just make a mess of the story like he does with every story he works on.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it would look really fucking good.
His music video approach to everything.
Yeah. Because, yeah, I was specifically thinking of Sucker Punch.
Yeah.
Because it kind of does have that same gothic feel that gothic has.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I'm like, no, I'm going to go with somebody who actually can direct a good film.
I love the look of Sucker Punch. It just fails story-wise.
Yeah. Like, almost everything Snyder's done since 300, but...
Yeah, it's a shame because, you know, I liked his early stuff way more than I like his stuff now. Yeah. So, yeah, that's my cast. I was pretty happy with how that one came out. I was constantly looking at actors and looking at the paintings of the character of these people, you know, of Shelley and Polidori. And Polidori was tough because, like, you look like Blackadder.
Yeah.
But I can't use him. He's too old.
Yeah.
You know what would be interesting to use? He played Perry in The Fall of the House of Usher. He's a very young-looking man, but he does have a Blackadder-ish type look.
Hmm. Yeah, but yeah, Robert Sheehan could be inserted into my cast in place of Jimmy Campbell Bauer quite easily as well.
Mm-hmm. I was like, I saw him, and I'm like, then I went to look at Byron, and I went back, and I'm like, fuck, that works.
There you go.
I was really happy about that one. That was the first one that clicked. I'm like, damn, I'm onto something here.
Nice.
The film here, it had a $4.5 million budget, which was about £2 million at the time. Mm-hmm. Its domestic box office here in Canada and the US was only $32,000. It had a very limited release. And then a worldwide gross of $916,000 and change. That would be a failure.
Yes.
But I didn't find the take on video, but obviously it was very successful.
Yeah.
Revived careers, made people household names, so got a lot of run in the video market. And the video market was kind of interesting. I mean, Sam and I come from that era as well, where you had clientels like, sure, they would watch the first run stuff that would come to video, the Terminator 2s and all that shit, but they were always looking for those weird movies too.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I lived in the middle of goddamn nowhere. Like, a young kid in southern Alberta, I wanted an art house film here and there.
Mm.
This sated my thirst.
Yeah, and home video was, like, the source for that. That was the place to go. And I'm not surprised that this did very well on home video. It gets forgotten how that really changed people's career trajectories just from that moment in time of the 80s and 90s into the 2000s where you were renting movies, and it was communal too, because you were constantly going to the video store, talking to people, talking to the staff, getting recommendations, and just, you know, it was a bit of a social activity.
It was. And particularly if you got a video store where the people who worked there were also film fans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And I say film fans rather than movie fans because there is a difference to me.
Yeah.
I love movies, but I also love film.
Yeah. Yeah, when you say social activity, like, I knew the people who ran it, and I'd go in there, and I could easily spend a trip to the video store could have been 2.5-3 hours, because we were visiting, and we were talking, and we were discussing.
Yeah, we had customers like that.
Yep.
Who would come in just to talk film.
Yeah, no, they'd always be hanging out, and like, oh, you have any recommendations? And I mean, that was the point of my life, is I learned to kind of quiz people on their tastes.
Yeah. We had people who'd bring us food, beer.
Yeah. It was a good time. Good time in our lives. Gothic has 5.7 out of 10 on IMDb. Now we're moving on to the Rotten Tomatoes game, Trish's favorite.
Oh, Okay, you know the point in the movie where everything goes to shit? This is mine.
Well, that's around 8 minutes in.
No. I'm talking like real shit. I'm Claire covered in mud. That's what I'm saying.
Fair enough. It's alive. It's alive. All right. What do you think the critics thought of the film?
You know what? This is kind of a critic thing. I'm going to go 61.
Yeah, it's actually a tough one. I'm going to say critics didn't like it. I'm going to go with a 52.
All right. I'm going to get the audience score before I reveal that one.
Okay. 56.
Ooh, good play. I'm going to go with, I was going to go 58, so I'm going to.
You're going to Price is Right me?
I'm going to Price is Right you.
Sam should have done that the first go around. Sam should have mixed it up too. He should have flipped those numbers. Critics gave it a 60%, so Trish was off by one.
Good job, Trish.
I did it.
That's right. But audiences didn't like it near as much at 49%.
Wow.
And I get that. I
it's not an audience film, like I said. It's a very specific audience.
Yeah, it's a specific audience, and it's definitely not going to be appealing to mass audiences.
No, I just happen to be part of that audience.
Yeah. This is one of those movies where it sits with me, and it's like, you know, as time goes on, if you hit me up next week, I'll probably like the movie.
Yeah.
But I know I'd seen this once before, and I didn't really remember it until I started sitting down and watching this. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I can see why I didn't watch this again, because I was probably a teenager when I watched it the first time, and I definitely wouldn't have appreciated it then.
The first time I saw it, I was probably 19 or 20, because I was still working at the first video store I worked at when I saw it.
I was probably younger than that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I would have been 19 or 20. And I remember it stuck with me then. I'm like, I really sort of got immersed in the experience. And in rewatching it, I mean, I don't love it the way I did the first time I saw it. But I still stand by it as being an interesting film to watch.
Interesting? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, right now in this moment of time, I wasn't crazy about it. But like I said, when you start looking into it and stuff, I kind of appreciated more of it.
You can see the art of that film now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you don't like the characters, right? And I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of people walk away from it not liking it, because there's nobody in this film that you can really glom onto as somebody that you empathize with or can even relate to. And
yes,
most movie-going audiences need that in order to enjoy a film. You need to have somebody that you connect with. And I mean, Mary's the one that most people might have been able to, but because of the time, the period film, and the fact that she – I hate to say this, but she might have been the worst performance in the film. I didn't feel like Natasha Richardson was really present in the film all that much. Like, I felt like she was kind of drifting through it. And maybe that was a choice.
And maybe, because, I mean, you looked at this script and cast in this, you might not actually understand what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think that failure to – she never really felt like a presence, which she's more than capable of, right? So I don't know if it was a choice, or maybe because it was so early in her career or direction. But I think the one character that audiences should have been able to grab onto, you couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, they for some reason thought we should be really grabbing on to Byron and Shelley, and it's like, no, thank you.
No, that's exactly it. Is you're not supposed to like those guys.
Yeah.
I mean, you're definitely not supposed to like Paula Dore, because he is – freaky and obsessive.
Yeah.
I mean, that scene.
I will say, with Timothy Spall, there is one moment in the movie where Mary is telling him about the loss of her baby. And I mean, he's touching her shoulder, but it seems to be the one time he's not being skeevy.
Yes.
There seems to be genuine care and tenderness. And I'm like, thank you, Timothy Spall. Thank you for bringing us that.
You can see in this movie why his career has spanned so many decades. And he didn't come into public consciousness until probably Rockstar, and then the Harry Potter films are kind of where modern audiences really took notice of him. But if you look at his filmography, he's been working since the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Like, he looks so young here. And back when Sam and I were roommates, he popped up in all sorts of movies we were watching all the time.
The best performance I've seen him in, and it's a hard, hard watch. I think it's called The Last Hangman.
I've not seen
that. And it was about the last guy who was hanging people in England. And it goes on about like how he'd have to figure out their weight and their height in order to make their next snap so they wouldn't suffer. It was a whole thing. It was a brilliant movie.
Very interesting. Well, I think that's it for Gothic from 1986. Another interesting birthday pick from Sam.
You're never going to get anything less.
Right?
But that is okay. If you like this episode, if you like any of our episodes, give us a follow on our social media at Invasion Remake on the artist formerly known as Twitter, Invasion of the Remake on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Threads, probably other places.
And just Google us.
That's right.
Damn it, just Google us.
And of course, you can email us invasionoftheremake@gmail.com if you want to send us your suggestions, your corrections, and your comments. And of course, those fan challenges, which of course, by now, you know, challenges need to be at least 20 years old film wise and somewhat accessible. So try to tell us where to find it if you know how to find it. You know, tell us there as well in that email, and it'll up your chances of it becoming a future episode. We'll give you a shout out as well.
Did you realize that this movie's almost 40 years old?
Mm-hmm. We're getting old. We are getting old. Ease our suffering of our age by giving us a 5-star rating and a short review over on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, because it helps get more
earballs
on the show. And go ahead and visit our website,
invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast.
And over there, you'll find all sorts of cool stuff. You'll find our archives of well over 400 episodes. You'll find lists from our 31 Days of Horror challenges. And you'll find how to listen to the show. Lots of different providers and links towards them so you can easily listen to the episode in the way you want to. And of course, there's a big old button that says
Store.
Store.
So hit that button. That'll take you to our Tee Public store. We got t-shirts, mugs, posters, PPE masks, and so much more, like totes and magnets and stickers and oh my.
Oh my.
Oh my.
So get your hand
on. I can feel it coming.
Get your hands on some sweet, sweet IOTR merch and be the cool kid on the block, and your help's keeping this show free for everyone every single week. And, you know, when you get there and you're shopping, like grab something of ours and then keep shopping until you check out, because we'll even get a little piece of any sale once you use that link. So,
Which is pretty cool.
So thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you in 2 weeks. Until then, I'm Jason.
I'm always Sam.
And I continue to be Trish.
And we are out of here.
Fateful night, Mary's son William was dead. Two more of the Shelley children later died at birth. Shelley himself drowned off the Gulf of Spezia in 1822. That same year, Allegra, Claire's daughter by Byron, also died. Byron survived her by 2 years, dying of fever in the Greek War. His biographer, Dr. Polidori, committed suicide in London. 8 years after the night at Diodati, only Claire and Mary remained alive. But something created that night 170 years ago lives on, still haunting us to this day. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.